This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be here.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And also from Britain, Warren Reinch.
Hello.
We've just finished our next edition of the Trumpet print magazine, and on the cover is one mop-haired blonde individual who has just become the new Prime Minister of Britain. The headline, Britain's Trump, and the subhead, Boris Johnson, aims to make Britain great again. That cover story was written by our man Richard Palmer, who has been following Mr. Johnson's activities this past week. So we'll begin by catching up on the latest from Richard.
Yes, we've now had Boris Johnson's big EU tour this week. I think a lot of people were surprised it didn't come sooner. He wanted to send a big message, I think, of we're not kind of coming with our begging bowl. We're not a supplicant. And so he put this visit off for a while and merely made sure that all the preparations back home were on target for Britain leaving the European Union on October 31st. But this was his week meeting the powers in Europe. So on Wednesday, he met with German Chancellor Angela Merkel. And then yesterday, he met with the French President Emmanuel Macron. And they talked about other things, but obviously the big thing they're discussing is going to be Brexit. And he came to those discussions. His message basically was, the deal on the table is completely unacceptable. We cannot accept this arrangement that splits Northern Ireland off from the rest of the UK. We cannot accept the UK remaining in the customs union with all of these EU laws until some undefined date. His other message was, we're ready to leave. We've been taking a lot of practical steps to go ahead and quit on October 31st. We are going to leave on October 31st, regardless. So what better deal can we do? Is there something that we can do to avoid us just leaving completely? And you know, his message was, well, you know, we might suffer, but you'll suffer too. German car manufacturers are already suffering. Britain's one of the biggest customers in the world for German cars. You know, you don't want us leaving completely on our own with no deal whatsoever, because then we'll put tariffs on German cars and all of those kind of things. So far, the main result seems to be that Angela Merkel said, well, okay, you've got 30 days to come up with an alternative proposal on what to do with Northern Ireland. And then Emmanuel Macron basically seconded that, which is unsurprising that France would end up just following whatever Germany said to do. So that's where we stand after that trip there.
So how much does this give us an indication? We were talking last week about just how Europe could break one of two ways, either recognize that Britain does have a little more leverage than it had before and try to be somewhat conciliatory, or it could do everything that it could to try to make things as difficult on Boris Johnson as possible. Any clues as to which direction they might be breaking?
I don't think so, but I think we might get some soon. A lot of people, the smart money is kind of saying that Europe is waiting at the moment to see what happens over the next couple of weeks once Britain's parliament opens. Because while Boris Johnson is doing this, you've got a pretty big operation within the UK from those that like the EU and that hate Brexit to stop him. So Parliament has already voted to leave the European Union 2-3 years ago, but in the wake of the referendum. But there's a lot of people, and there's even a majority in Parliament to stop that. So you've got this guerrilla movement now, led by senior members of the Conservative Party who don't like Brexit, led by the House Speaker John Bercow, and Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the Labour Party, the Liberal Democrats, and basically they're plotting to potentially bring down the government in order to stop Brexit from happening. Now, in order to do that, they've got to get into some parliamentary shenanigans, and they've also got to agree on an alternative prime minister. And the idea is to put in a caretaker prime minister who could come into power, who could stop Brexit, and then he would leave fairly soon after that. The big thing preventing these plotters from succeeding so far is they cannot agree on who that prime minister should be. Jeremy Corbyn insists that it must be him, and it can't be anybody else. The Liberal Democrats have said it should be them. The Conservative plotters have said it should be them. That's what's dividing them. So a lot of people are saying, well, Europe's waiting now. If these, I don't know, the word that's coming to mind is traitors, which I think is accurate. If these traitors in Parliament manage to get rid of Boris Johnson and manage to overturn the will of the British people, then the EU may well work with them. So they're saying the EU is waiting and seeing. They're not going to offer Boris Johnson any concessions until this has come to a head. Because if they do come out and offer him concessions, it kind of validates him. It's going to give him more power. If they don't, and if it makes it, they want to really play up this idea right now that a no-deal Brexit will be a disaster, it will be a train crash. They're really trying to send this message because they're hoping to push support to that cabal that wants to reverse Brexit. So we're going to see that, I think, come to a head. Once Parliament begins to meet at the beginning of September, that's when we'll start to see exactly, you know, have they agreed on a unified candidate, what's going to happen there.
So when we spoke about this before, Richard, we were talking about just how much the fact that the United States has been so favorable to making a trade deal with Britain, that Donald Trump is so favorable toward Brexit, gives Boris Johnson a lot more leverage in his dealings with European leaders. How much do we see that in play? And I guess the relationship between Britain and the United States being, say, a good alternative to what Boris Johnson is facing across the channel.
Yeah, it's certainly something we have seen in play, if not over the last few days, certainly in the last fortnight or so, where you had John Bolton, for example, traveling to the UK, and he was very pro-Brexit in his comments and very critical of the European Union. You had Pompeo again offering a very positive speech and saying, you know, we're going to work as quickly as we can to get a trade deal with Britain. So there's a whole lot of support there. And yeah, I think there's some really interesting questions about, without Donald Trump's victory, would you even have a Prime Minister Boris Johnson right now? And I mean, we talked about this before, but if you had someone like Hillary Clinton as president who said that I've been against Brexit from the start, it's a horrible idea. You know, if she would be right behind Theresa May's deal. She would be telling Britain, yes, sign a deal with the European Union. It's the best that you're going to get. And so, yeah, would under those circumstances, I think when you see how pro-Europe so much of the parliament is, I think under those circumstances, then, yeah, they would have approved Theresa May's capitulation to the European Union. And so when you look at how things would have looked under President Hillary Clinton right now, then, yeah, I think you can make a strong case that President Donald Trump is saving Britain from the European Union right now, which is, this is where just the Bible prophecy in this whole aspect comes alive. Because one of the oldest prophecies that we've talked about, that Herbert W. Armstrong talked about, is that there would be this superpower being raised up in Europe that would be raised up ultimately to punish Britain and America. It's a power that is fundamentally opposed to Britain and America. And we see this even in the values and the way the European Union operates. They're very different to the values cherished by Britain and America, which is why you always had this friction. So, you know, that was there. Then Mr. Armstrong said for a long time that Britain would not be part of this coming power. Britain joined the European Union right from the moment they joined, Mr. Armstrong said. There, it's not going to work. It's going to be a disaster for Britain. They're not going to be a part of this final power that the European Union turns into. So we've seen it be a disaster with Britain. We've seen Britain ultimately decide, yeah, this hasn't been good. We're getting out of here. Now you have these prophecies that we've been talking about much more recently, where the Bible talks about there being a modern type of King Jeroboam II that led to a resurgence in America, ancient King Jeroboam II led to a resurgence in ancient Israel, a comeback for ancient Israel, where things were going badly, and then they reached their largest territorial extent ever. And the Bible says that God saved Israel during that period through this King Jeroboam II. And so Mr. Flurry has written about, I think it was in the summer last year, he talked about how, well, today we can see God saving Israel, saving America through one individual, a modern Jeroboam II. And he went and showed from the Bible how this is referring to President Trump. And what's interesting is you can go back and see what he was writing. And when he was saying Israel, he was very clear he wasn't just talking about America. He included Britain and he included Israel in that, that God was saving America, but also Britain and Israel through this Jeroboam II. And what do we see now? Well, we see this same individual, President Trump, helping save Britain from the European Union, from this power that's being raised up to punish Britain, from this power that's ultimately hostile to Britain. Now, the Bible is very clear that this is a temporary salvation, a temporary reprieve. In the Bible with King Jeroboam II, he died pretty soon, pretty soon after he died, everything fell apart, the nation fell into civil war, it went badly very fast. And this power in Europe is still being raised up to punish Britain. It's not, Britain is not saved permanently from the European Union. But you've just had this really prophetic event where you see President Trump helping break Britain, at least temporarily, outside of the clutches of this European power.
Yeah, it's a very good overview that you just gave us there. And really, it points to this cover story of our next Trumpet edition. Richard wrote this article, Making Britain Great Again. This issue will come out next week online. It's our October 2019 edition. We sent it to the press yesterday. So you can watch for that article coming up on thetrumpet.com on the front page there. And we really appreciate that, Richard, and it sounds like we've got a lot more to look forward to here in the next couple of weeks as we continue to see this drama play out, and particularly leading up to that date at the end of October when Britain is supposed to leave the European Union for good. So we appreciate that. Large combined military drills taking place among the giants of Asia next month. To learn about this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, Russia and seven of its allies and partners will be holding massive military drills. It's called Center 2019, named after the part of Russia where it takes place there, sort of in the central region. This was announced by Russia's defense ministry on Tuesday. And the list of nations that's taking part is really impressive. China will be sending thousands of its troops, and so will India. And also five of the big stands, Pakistan, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan. These drills will be happening at eight different locations in the central region of Russia, and they'll take place from the 16th to the 21st of September. And so these eight militaries will focus on air defense operations, simulated combat, and counterterrorism. And altogether, they'll have 128,000 military personnel from these countries taking part, and 20,000 pieces of equipment, 600 aircraft, and 15 naval vessels as well. So with those kinds of numbers, these drills will be among the largest that Russia has ever held.
Just looking at the list of the people of the countries who are participating, it seems like we've talked about some of the the tensions and political machinations between some of these entities. What does it say that they're willing to kind of bury the hatchet, come together, and do these drills together?
I think that's really a huge part of this story, because it's a strange set of bedfellows that you have here. When you consider the tensions between India and China, which have flared up again recently over Kashmir, the tensions between India and Pakistan have flared up far more over the Kashmir situation. There's also deep tensions between Kazakhstan and China and Kyrgyzstan and China over, well, the Kyrgyz and the Kazakh populations are irate about China's treatment of Uyghur Muslims. So there are some really serious tensions, even some animosity between these participating countries. And I think the fact that they're willing to fight shoulder to shoulder with each other, despite all those tensions, you know, the fact that they're willing to take part in these games that Russia's hosting, despite all that, is a real testimony to Russia's leadership and to Russia's power. It just shows the deep influence that Russia has over these nations. Geopolitical Futures wrote a little bit about this yesterday and said, quote, "It's a sign that Moscow still holds a large degree of influence over this part of the world." So I think it really shows that Russia is just in a unique and a powerful position here, and that it's able to bring these countries together in a way that nobody else could.
It's so interesting. We have discussions about how difficult it's been for Europe to come together in any kind of unified military operation. And there are, you know, all these smaller agreements that are taking place between two and three countries at a time. There's desire, there's rhetoric. It seems like Asia just doesn't have the same kind of issues that Europe does, that they're doing these kinds of drills somewhat routinely and on a pretty massive scale.
That's true. I'm not sure what accounts for the discrepancy there, but it does seem like the Asians are able to come together pretty meaningfully.
Richard, you have a comment.
Yeah, I think Europe's militaries are already dramatically more integrated than Asia's are. I think we're just kind of comparing apples and oranges a bit. Europe's militaries drill together in even closer drills all the time with NATO exercises. Mm. European Union doesn't really do so many, but you have partner exercises, this kind of thing. And I think it's just the difference between an alliance versus some of the Europe's ambitions are just so much higher. And so because we're kind of measuring Europe against the scale of their ambitions, we see them falling short. Whereas Asia, they've only ever really talked about a military alliance rather than some kind of much more unified military.
Yeah. Well, that is a very good point. When we're looking at what's happening here in Asia, anytime we see military cooperation on this kind of a scale, it points to those Bible prophecies of what we can expect militarily from Asia in the future.
That's right, yes. Bible prophecy says in the end time, an Asian power will rise up and it'll play a major role in the final world war. The prophecies say that Russia will be the head of this force. But scripture also says it'll field an army of 200 million men. So that's obviously far more than Russia could do on its own. That's more than Russia's total population. But there is a passage in Ezekiel 38 that lists ancient names for China and India and several other nations and shows that they will be under Russia's leadership in this Asian confederacy. So they'll throw their military muscle behind it. And when you start to add up the populations of these other nations, it's really easy to see how that 200 million man force could be built up. So I think when we see these nations holding these kind of drills together and laying aside their differences to do it and doing it all under Russian leadership, it's just really easy to see how that is sort of laying the foundation for the fulfillment of those Bible prophecies.
Where could we read more about that?
Russia and China in Prophecy. This is a booklet that we've had out for several years. It's been gone through several updates and really lays out the current events alongside the Bible prophecies in a powerful way.
Thank you, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. In the Gulf state of Yemen, a drama is playing out between Saudi Arabia and Iran. It looks like it could end up with the latter having something of a permanent presence there astride one of the world's most important shipping lanes. For this, we'll turn to Warren Reinsch.
In a major development, the anti-Houthi coalition appears to have fractured. The New York Times reported on July 11th that after 4 years of devastating war, the United Arab Emirates has withdrawn from the Saudi and United States-backed anti-Houthi coalition. So in Yemen, the anti-Houthis coalition is the majority is Saudi Arabia, and then you also have the United Arab Emirates, and the Americans have also been backing that coalition. The Houthi coalition is mainly just supported by Iran, and according to this Times article, the fact that United Arab Emirates is leaving the coalition, this is a huge groundbreaking development because according to them, it is or the UAE was a linchpin of this Saudi-led war in Yemen, unquote. So this is a huge development, and according to the Arab Weekly, without the Emirates' support, then a return to united Yemen is no longer possible. By leaving the coalition, the UAE has in essence endorsed the Southern Transition Council, to separate and to create their own state of South Yemen. This is a big development because in 1990 was when there was finally a unified Yemen. Before, there was always North Yemen and there was a South Yemen. So that's basically what it's looking like is going to happen. We're going to have a divided Yemen once again. Only this time, it looks like there might be three different nations here. In an article entitled "The Looming Partition of Yemen," Al Jazeera wrote this, quote, "The success of Yemen's southern secessionists in taking over the city of Aden has effectively undermined all efforts to restore legitimate authority to the government of President Hadi. If not reversed, the takeover of Aden by southern secessionists may well be the final nail in the coffin of Yemen's unity," unquote. And in the same article, then they drew away three major developments from this Aden crisis. And they said this, quote, "First, today's status quo may hold, allowing the Southern Transitional Council to maintain its control over Aden and its maritime facilities. Second, the Hadi government may be successful in holding on to areas in the interior, which will effectively create two power spheres in the south. Third, the preoccupation of the Hadi government with its with the challenge that the secessionists pose in the south may give the Houthis an opportunity to increase their military pressure on Saudi Arabia. This most likely will result in the establishment of a Houthi state in northern Yemen and a vassal state supported by the UAE in the south," end quote. So what that means is that we are going to have three different states in Yemen: the Saudi-backed Hadi government, and then the Houthi government, which is backed by Iran, and then another government in the south, which is backed by the UAE. But this is a huge development because it basically calls for the creation of a Houthi state, an Iranian-backed terrorist nation that would become a state just because out of people not doing anything to attack it, to stop it from becoming a state. And this would be a huge development mainly because of the positioning. Yemen is located on the coast of one of the world's most dangerous shipping lanes. It is a shipping lane that's vital for world trade because it facilitates roughly 4.8 million barrels of oil and petroleum every day. And that was according to data from the National Interest. It's also a huge threat to Israel because Israel has about billions of dollars of trade that flows through that shipping lane. And Israel imports about 28% of its crude petroleum and approximately a sixth of its refined petroleum from Asia. And most of that is going to travel through this trade route. So it's a very important area for world trade. And now you have an Iranian-backed state that could be set up, which could very, very definitely impact this world trade. And this is something that the Trumpets followed for a long time. Mr. Fleury, our editor-in-chief, wrote this in his Libya and Ethiopian prophecy. He said this, "But what if you have radical Islamic nations along the sea trade route with real air power, including missiles? That could give Iran virtual control of the trade through those seas. Radical Islam could stop the flow of essential oil to the United States and Europe," end quote. So this is something that the Trumpet has watched for a long time because it aligns with a prophecy in Daniel 11 and verse 40, which says that at the time of the end, the king of the south will push at him. It will push at this king of the north, this European power. And it has a huge impact, as we already mentioned. Even just shutting down this trade route would increase the time it takes for these oil vessels to get from the Persian Gulf to, let's say, Rotterdam by 78%. Or a journey from the Persian Gulf to Italy would take three times as long. And this would have an impact on the world economy. It would make prices, oil prices spike around the world. And it's a very important development that we need to watch because the Houthis have proven that they're willing to use their missile power on various nations like Saudi Arabia, like the United Arab Emirates. But how long until they start targeting these ships traveling through this important trade route? And that could just be a few months away.
Yeah, we have been following Iran's strategy for gaining control over those crucial oil shipping lanes. And really, its activities in Yemen have been a major part of that strategy for some time. So to be watching it really on the cusp of cementing its control over at least a portion of that nation is quite alarming. It has to be alarming to Saudi Arabia, and it has to be alarming to anyone who is dependent on oil supplies coming from the Middle East. Europe would certainly be among them. So you know that there is going to be ramifications. There's going to be ripple effects from what's happening here, that there are a lot of nations that are watching this very closely. And we'll see exactly how that unfolds, but certainly something that we need to keep our eyes on quite closely. Thank you very much for that, Warren. We'll talk now about America's economy. How's it doing? Some say it's fantastic. Some say that it needs stimulating. And some, like President Donald Trump, say both of these things. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of contradictory or seemingly contradictory information going out there around the American economy. The unemployment rate's lower than it's been in decades. The stock market, for the most part, is doing well. Nation's still in the midst of an economic boom, but the Federal Reserve slashed the interest rates that banks lend money to each other by 0.25% last June, and President Trump's really ramping up the pressure for them to do even more. He sent out this tweet on Monday, which I'll just read. He said, "Our economy is very strong, despite the horrendous lack of vision by Jay Powell and the Fed. But the Democrats are trying to will the economy to be bad for the purposes of the 2020 election. Very selfish. Our dollar is so strong that it is sadly hurting other parts of the world. The Fed rate, over a fairly short period of time, should be reduced by at least 100 basis points, with perhaps some quantitative easing as well. If that happens, our economy will be even better, and the world economy will be greatly and quickly enhanced for good for everyone." So he's calling for the Federal Reserve to actually slash interest rates another 1% in addition to the 0.25% they just got slashed. That would take the whole rate down to about 1% total, and maybe even some quantitative easing. So these are measures that governments normally take during recessions to encourage people to start borrowing. Like he said in the tweet, he's wanting to take this before a recession so that the economy is good during the 2020 election. But it just does show that this economic resurgence is temporary, because the only reason you'd call for a Fed cut and quantitative easing when the economy is good, unless you're a lunatic, is
to
you're expecting
ward off a problem.
The economy is going to get bad within the next short period of time. There's actually also another warning sign is we're currently in a what they call an inverted yield curve, where America's charging more interest for a 2-year treasury bond than a 10-year treasury bond. Normally you charge the more interest on the 10-year bond because you don't have to pay, you want people to buy that one because then you don't have to pay them back till like 10 years from now. The only reason you'd actually give more interest on a 2-year bond is if you're having problems getting selling 2-year bonds because people think something bad's going to happen in the next 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think these are some great points, but it's not just an American problem. You can really see something building globally. I think one just weird piece of economic news that you saw this week is Denmark has started doing negative interests for some mortgages. So I mean, what that means basically is in certain circumstances, the bank will pay you to take out a mortgage. Which I still can't really get my head around that's pretty bizarre. But the point is that interest rates have gotten so low that some places in the world are actually charging negative interest rates. They're paying you to borrow money and they're charging you to save, which is just, you know, trying to incentivize getting as much money out into the economy as we can now to for a short-term boost.
Right. So these are stimulating factors that they're employing in a time that is apparently good, but the only time that you're using this in the past is when you're trying to kind of stimulate your way out of a recession. Not a good sign.
No, not a good sign at all. And there's 2 points from the the Bible I'll make about this. The one is more of just a general good financial planning. This is a problem that's plagued pretty much all democracies throughout history. Seems to be America in particular, is because you're trying to cater to an electorate to vote you back into office. Tighten your belt is a bad message to get reelected. And so there's this urge to kick economic problems down the road.
Yep.
When in reality, when the economy is good right now, this is when you should have been saving up money for when the next recession comes. Actually, King Solomon makes a point about that in Proverbs 6, verses 6 through 8, where he just says, go to the ant, you sluggard, consider her ways and be wise. It has no guide, no overseer, no ruler, yet it provides her meat in the summer and gathers her food for the harvest. So if you watch an ant, I mean, the ant's brain is not very big, but she knows that when it's summer, store some seeds away someplace because seeds don't grow in the winter.
Yeah.
That's something that, and a nation like America, I mean, we've had 10 good years, 10 good economic years since 2009, that they haven't paid down any of the national debt. Consumer debt did go down just because a bunch of people went bankrupt, but now even that's back to what it was in 2008. And so you've come full circle. But then the second point being, Richard already talked some in the beginning about this program about one of Mr. Armstrong's oldest prophecies being this rise of a European super state. And we have a article we can put in the show notes entitled "Our Financial 9/11 Was Prophesied." Actually, it's not an article. It's a chapter in the book He Was Right about the prophecies that Mr. Armstrong made that are have turned out to be correct so far. And there's more prophecies he made that will be correct in the future. But that book talks about that financial 9/11 talks about that. Like right now, America is stronger than Europe. But the prophecy indicates that's going to change, and that is a financial banking crisis is very likely to be the catalyst that brings that prophecy to fruition and elevates one power up and brings the other power down.
Yeah. Yeah, that chapter from He Was Right really is compelling. And it's interesting, at the time, 2008, the way that they were talking about that, we were right on the precipice of like economic Armageddon in the United States. It's gone on for quite a lot longer than we expected, yet all the fundamentals that were in place at that time are still true. So it's an interesting read to go back and look at what we were saying immediately after that happened. And as is the case so often, the timing hasn't unfolded the way that we expected, but the fundamentals of the prophecy remain intact. So we'll keep our eyes peeled on how that unfolds. We appreciate that very much, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, an update on Italy's politics and how it could contribute to prophecy being fulfilled in Europe, and Russia continuing to slowly expand its borders. These stories and more, we'll be right back.
Is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
We spoke last week about what's happening within Italy, leading to the formation of a new government. That happened this week, and it could bring about the rise of yet another European strongman who happens to be Catholic. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, so Italy finally got the fall of its government that we said could happen last week. The prime minister officially resigned, and he gave a very critical speech where he directly accused the Matteo Salvini, this individual we also talked about last week, who would be the likely victor of any election. He accused him of breaking up the coalition, of putting party before country and all of this. And so he resigned. But Italy doesn't go straight to elections. Now there's somebody has got until the middle of next week to come up with an alternative coalition. And what we've got is something a bit similar to what we've got in Britain right now, where a lot of the other Italian political parties don't want another election because Matteo Salvini is in the polls to do incredibly well, which means the mainstream parties are on the running to do incredibly badly. So he's they've got an incentive to stop this. However, the other parties don't really get on either. So the big question now that everyone's watching for is, can there be a Stop Salvini coalition by the middle of next week, or are we going to fresh polls? And, you know, I don't know which way that's going to go, but even if you do get a Stop Salvini coalition, it's obviously not a stable coalition. So basically, it's just people that don't have much in common apart from the fact they don't want the people to vote because the people will vote in someone they don't like. So you've got this situation where Italy's path from here on out either looks like Germany right now, mm-hmm. where you have an unstable coalition, which leads to just more support for these new upstart parties, which leads to more dissatisfaction among voters for just not just the political parties, but politics in general, the standard way of doing things, just even liberal democracy. So they can go down that route, or there'll be fresh elections and you'll be very likely to see a strong man coming to the fore in terms of Matteo Salvini that has a very different view of the European Union to the kind of the bureaucrats that are in Brussels right now. He has a view of a European Union that's much more muscular, that's much more Catholic, that does much more to keep out migrants, to defend itself. So it basically seems like that's where Italy's heading. If it's not heading there next week, it's just setting up the stage for a much harsher turn in that direction in the future.
So this is a man who doesn't have a lot of fans among the ruling elites in Italy and in Europe, but the people love him. Tell us what makes him so popular.
Well, I think really it's because he's a strong man and he's a man of action. That's one key part of it, and the other is just his charisma. So he got into his big issue in the last election was migration. We're going to deal with the migrant crisis, and we're going to deal with it strongly. And he has absolutely followed through on that. Whether people agree with him or disagree with him, you know, no one disagrees that he's followed through on that promise. He has basically gone to ports, and you know, there'll be a ship full of migrants coming there saying, well, we need to enter for humanitarian reasons. There's sickness, there's whatever, let us in. And he said, no, you're not coming into Italy. You're not going to set foot on Italian soil. Turn that boat around, get it right back out in the ocean. You're not coming in here. And that's part of the reason why you have this love-hate response to him. There are people in Italy that are just fed up of the migrant crisis. You know, they haven't recovered from the economic crisis. Mm. You've got regions of Italy with just stunningly high levels of unemployment. And now on top of that, they see literally hundreds of thousands of migrants coming in, and the government may be paying to look to house those often cases and look after them. They're getting jobs in some cases. And so the ordinary Italians are saying, well, what's going on there? I thought I wanted a government that cared about me, not the inhabitants of some other country. Mm-hmm. And they've been getting very angry. And Matteo Salvini has really put that into practice. He hasn't let them down in the way that a whole lot of other politicians have. Then the other part of it is this charisma. You know, he's been going around over the summer, visiting crowds on beaches. He always mingles with the crowd. He'll often come up there without his shirt on, which, like we talked about last week, so much of the style and the way he represents himself is very reminiscent of Benito Mussolini. His interaction with the crowds, the posing topless with crowds is exactly the kind of thing that Mussolini would do. So there are some fairly far right or at least right wing things that he does, but it's his style and way of, and strongman image and way of doing politics that provokes the most comparisons with Italy's fascist era.
So give us the prophetic perspective here.
Yeah, so like we've talked about before on this show, one of the big things we're watching is for the rise of a power, a European power. There's so many scriptures that talk about that in the Bible, and Revelation 17 is one of the key places that talks about it, and that talks about it being led, this modern revival of this European power led by 10 kings. Now, there's one strong man in charge at the top. Revelation talks about that. Daniel chapter 8, Daniel chapter 11 talks about that. But then at the same time, you know, you wouldn't expect one strong leader at the top with 10 committees underneath him. This is something that's going to change the whole character of the regime. And then Revelation, as it said, it talks about 10 kings. These are kind of smaller, strong men underneath him. Obviously, I don't know whether Salvini is going to be one of those kings, but you see king-like politics becoming popular, a politics that does away with the norms of liberal democracy, that does things a new and a different way. And another key prophecy about this European power is that it will have a very strong church-state relationship. Revelation chapter 17 talks about it being ridden by a woman, which in biblical symbolism is the church, and this is referring to the Catholic Church. And Salvini, well, he has a very interesting relationship with the Catholic Church. He has been pretty directly criticized by the Pope, because the Pope is kind of all into his hugger migrant kind of thing. But at the same time, he really and deliberately puts forward a very Catholic image. He talks about Mary, for example, all the time in his speeches. And so he really paints himself as being a core Catholic and draws a lot on the that Catholic heritage. So you see him, even if he's not one of these kings, he is right in line with what the Bible says to expect for Europe. And you're seeing this kind of leader rise to the top, not just in Italy, but in Austria, in Poland, in several of these countries now, all across Europe, as you see Europe making real motion towards what the Bible says it's going to look like.
All right, excellent. Well, we have an article on the website by Josue Michels, El Capitano Matteo Salvini, Italy's Crisis or Opportunity. Go check that out. It's quite a major feature story there on the front page of thetrumpet.com with the prophetic significance of what's happening over there. Thank you for that, Richard. Russia's occupation of Georgia continues to slowly, quietly advance. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, it's time now for our biannual update on Russia's ongoing expansion into Georgia. I'm not sure if we actually cover it with that frequency, but this is something that we have to keep on coming back to, because the Russians just keep creeping deeper and deeper into this tiny country and adding more and more of it to the territory that's essentially a part of Russia now. So the latest victim over the last couple of weeks was a village called Gugathanskari. At the beginning of this month, Gugathanskari was located just south of the Russian-controlled region called South Ossetia. But this month, the Russians moved their fences further south, and so now Gugathanskari is inside of South Ossetia. It's been annexed, and the residents there have had to either flee their homes and farms or be caged inside of Russia. But it was 11 years ago this month that Russia invaded Georgia and asserted control over what amounted to about a fifth of its territory. And at that time, Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury said Russia's invasion marked the beginning of a dangerous new era in history. And so I think it's, now here we are 11 years on, and we can look back and see that Russia has engaged in dozens of these incidents of what is called borderization, just slowly moving the border, usually just a few acres at a time, to expand the size of the Russian-controlled area there. I spoke yesterday with a political commentator in Georgia's capital, Tbilisi, a man named Dr. Yerikla Bokushava. And he said he thinks this will continue until Georgia finds a way to meaningfully stand up to Russia. And it's hard to see how that would ever happen, really, right, just given the vast disparity between the two countries' military power. So it's clear that Mr. Fleury was exactly right when he said that 2008 invasion marked the start of a dangerous new era.
Russia does it because it know it can get away with it. There's the town that you're naming, all of these little, like you've said, salami slices that it's taking. They're not aggressive enough for the international community to say, okay, that's it. You've crossed a line that we can't countenance.
That's right. Yeah, I think by doing it gradually like this, they sort of stave off any sort of reaction. At this point, though, I wonder what it would take for the so-called international community to take action. Even if Russia were to be a bit more bold and take a huge chunk, I'm not sure who would stand up to them at this point.
So could you give us a bit more about the prophecy, why what Vladimir Putin is doing is so prophetically significant, or the fact that he's taking these kinds of moves just gives us an indication that he really is going to fulfill the role that Gerald Fleury has laid out?
Yes. Yeah, sure. Mr. Fleury has written a very powerful booklet called The Prophesied Prince of Russia, and he shows how really deeply significant Putin's leadership of Russia is, in large part because Putin or his office are mentioned in an ancient Bible prophecy. It's a prophecy in Ezekiel 38, verse 2, and it talks about a prince of Rosh, or Russia. And then Mr. Fleury writes, quote, "We need to watch Vladimir Putin closely. I believe he is almost certain to be the Prince of Rosh, whom God inspired Ezekiel to write about 2,500 years ago. We need to watch what is happening in Russia and how Europe responds to it." And then, you know, that passage there in Ezekiel, it goes on to show that this prince, this Russian prince, will become aggressive, and he will lead a bloc of Asian nations. As we talked about in the first half of the show there, you can see evidence of that with those military drills that are being held. But Mr. Fleury also shows that there is profound hope tied into the developments that are now underway. He writes, quote, "Vladimir Putin is a sign, literally a sign that Jesus Christ is about to return. This is one of the most inspiring messages in the Bible. What we are seeing in Russia ultimately leads to the transition from man ruling man to God ruling man, and it's almost here." So, you know, it's clear that Putin's leadership is multiplying the dangers in Georgia and around the world, but there's also just so much hope tied to this because it shows that we're very close to that era of righteous leadership.
Thank you for that, Jeremiah. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. We will finish with a story about a new poll on Americans' views of evolution and God. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yes, since 1982, Gallup's done an annual poll on American belief on where did humans come from. And this year's poll shows that a record number of Americans believe that God had nothing to do with mankind's development. Actually, it'd be a full 22% of people polled in this survey said that mankind evolved over time and God had nothing to do with it. Now that compares with 33% that said mankind evolved over time but God was helping him evolve. And then 40% who said that mankind was sculpted by God in his image and likeness, the way the book of Genesis reveals. But if you put those two numbers, the 33% who believe God created evolution and the 22% who believe God had nothing to do with evolution, together, that's 55%, a majority of American adults that believe in human evolution. And this is a something that when you watch this Gallup poll, sometimes it ebbs and flows, but it's definitely a dramatic rise over the years. They, like I said, they started in 1982, and back then only 9% of Americans believed that people evolved with no help or aid from God. So that's over doubled in the years since then. And even that belief that God is directing evolution, that's a popular belief. Actually, most Catholics in America and probably around the world believe that. The Pope Francis has endorsed that, but it is kind of like a gateway drug, if you will, when you see how 20th centuries unfolded, where you had a nation 100 years ago that believed that God created human beings for the most part. And then the idea like, well, maybe God created evolution became more and more common. And then after that, it's like, well, maybe there just is evolution became more and more common. But back when that was starting, back all the way in 1928, it was actually one of the first articles, maybe even the first article, I should double check that, that Herbert W. Armstrong wrote on evolution, where he's talking about evolution is the devil's most powerful modern weapon. And he has this to say in that that 1928 article. When Satan destroys belief in creation, when the devil succeeds in convincing men that this earth was not created by an all-powerful being, but that it came by continuous progressive change, by natural causes according to fixed laws brought about only through residential forces, then Satan has destroyed the proof of God. And that is, like I said, one of his most powerful modern weapon, because well, like people who listen to this show know that this this show is based on interpreting news events through the lens of Bible prophecy. But to do that, you have to first believe in Bible prophecy, and then to believe in Bible prophecy, you have to believe in the Bible, and to believe in the Bible, you have to believe in God. And so if the devil can convince one out of every five Americans that God had nothing to do with man's creation, you've cut him off at the knees. You don't even get to the Bible prophecy part, because you don't believe in divinely inspired prophecies if God's not real. Once you've gotten a person's mindset that far, it is hard to like you've got to start right from the base, re-educating the ground up to be able to understand the news events and the world around you. And I think that's why it's so important for people to understand the book. We'll put in the show notes from Mr. Armstrong, Does God Exist? And that booklet, and it actually doesn't even mention the Bible much. It's mostly aimed at an audience proving scientifically and rationally that God is real, and then building on that foundation. Mr. Armstrong had another book, The Proof of the Bible, that takes you the next step, and then all sorts of writings on Bible prophecy that takes the next step. But that book really is the foundation, especially if you're one of those 22% of Americans who doesn't believe that God has all that much to do with where mankind came from.
You know, considering just how long that higher education has been teaching evolution and pushing God aside and teaching a view of creation without a creator, it's kind of remarkable how resilient the idea that God actually did create a man in his own image is. If it's something like 40%, the fact that you have 55% of people who don't believe in the biblical view, but there are still some who believe that God is playing some kind of a role in evolutionist processes is quite interesting. But another thing that comes to my mind is the Key of David program that Gerald Flurry did on that subject in particular. The title of that program was A True Christian Cannot Believe in Evolution. The idea that, like, say, what the Pope is doing, where he's taking this middle ground that, yes, I believe in God and I believe in evolution, is really a repudiation of the biblical revelation as much as the 22% who believe God didn't have anything to do with it when you really look at it. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes, as well as the booklet that Andrew mentioned there, Does God Exist? By Herbert W. Armstrong. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that's it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com for links to all the articles and the literature that we discussed on today's program. You can email us your thoughts to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Warren Reinch, and Richard Palmer. And I'll leave you with the words of George Bernard Shaw: the liar's punishment is not in the least that he is not believed, but that he cannot believe anyone else. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.